And so we are back this morning looking at the Bible's big story and working hand in hand with the Bible's big story by Sally Lloyd-Jones. And just in case you've not been aware, if you click on the website, it'll also take you to a small video. So if you prefer not to read, even though it's just a few pages, you'll find on the website a link to the video. And you've got a much nicer voice to listen to than mine, with David Suchet doing the narrating. But we come to the story of Abraham, and in some ways this is what some people call the third act of the Bible, of God's story of salvation. And the opening verses of Genesis are Genesis 12 are extraordinary. They are in some ways the centerpiece of the whole Bible, even though it comes right at the start. And it needs the rest of the Bible to unpack what happens here. And you can only really understand the Bible story and our part in it and how we are drawn into it by reading the story of Abraham's life. And remarkably, what happens here in these centerpiece verses is that it is the story of salvation, of God's work of rescue. And it begins, and it sets a pattern that is then repeated again, again, and again in the Bible. It starts with a marker of a promise and an unusual birth. A promise and an unexpected arrival. And yet, even as we begin to unpack these verses, and we're trying to look from chapter 12 all the way through to chapter 21, it is the same theme with which we began. The two themes, if those of you have been here week by week, can you remember what they are? Both ours? No one remembers. What are they? To be fair, I've only said it six Sundays in a row. Revelation and rescue. If somebody asks you, what is the theme of the Bible? It is these two things. Revelation, God saying, here I am. Rescue, God saying, this is what I will do. It's the same theme. But it's unpacked because the promises of God suddenly become applied in a very particular way. But there is something striking about these opening verses that doesn't sit comfortably with us. And if you were in small group and read those chapters about God saying to Mary, you will give birth to a child, you will understand what I mean. When God came to Mary, did he give her an option? Did he invite her into his plan and purpose? And what we discover here is that these verses begin with the sovereignty of God. Even if you look at it in the opening verses, it is all about what the Lord is doing. Everything here that is unfolding is at God's initiative. God is on the move. And it even begins with what it says. It says, now the Lord, and then it's deliberately the capital L-O-R-D, God's covenant name, said to Abraham, go from your country. He didn't come and say, would you like to? He comes not with an invitation, but with a command. He's the king. We sometimes speak about the gospel invitation, don't we? Who was it, the lady who used to live with Father Ted at Holcombe, who would always go, go on, go on, go on, go on. Is that what God is like? Oh, go on, go on, go on. He's the king. He doesn't come with a gospel invitation. He comes with a gospel command. And look at how striking it is. Abram is just getting on with life, and God says, go from your country. It's God's command. But what is striking and difficult for us is not only God's command to go, but it says nothing about why Abram. Nothing. There's nothing about his gifts and his talents. There's nothing about him that stands out. And what we see, the first of all, is the sovereignty of God that says go, and the sovereignty of God's choice that says, I choose you, Abram. And here God's call, on the other hand, and the question is, well, if there is a call, what is God's call? What is it that God is looking for? What is God looking for from your life? He's looking for you to trust him, and he's looking for you to obey him. And here's the problem with these verses in Genesis. It really gets here to the modern man or woman. Because the last thing we want is what? Anyone telling us to go anywhere. I have discovered that when I used to usher, whenever I wanted people to go in one direction, I asked them to go a different direction. Because there is that bit in all of us that when somebody says to you, go, we go, who do you think you are to tell me I am the master of my own destiny? But here's the king. If God is the one who is saying go, if God is the one who is making the choice, and even though it challenges our heart and we find that bit creeping up inside us, the king question is this: what kind of king is he? No offense, if King Charles came to my house and chapped to the door and said, I'm coming in to have tea with you today, no chance. You just can't wander in and just assume. But here is a sovereign king who is loving beyond description, who's gracious beyond compare, who's compassionate in ways that we cannot fathom. And so because it is this king who says, go, because it is this king who says, I choose you, it changes everything. Because you see both his sovereignty and his grace. But if there is a call here, what is God calling Abraham to? Is it to Canaan? And here is something to hold on to as we begin this morning, and to hold on to in our own lives, and to hold on to as we go through the whole of the Bible. God's call is to what? To himself. To himself. And unfolding in the story of Abraham, we see the sovereignty of God that breaks into the world and says, Abraham, go. That says, Abraham, I've chosen you, and I'm calling you to myself. And so you've got the command of the king. And there's an unfolding story that we don't have time for to look at this morning that runs from chapter 12 all the way through to the end of chapter 21. And it's a great read because in it there is extraordinary commitment. And if you've ever wondered, how do you describe faith? Well, you look at someone like Abraham and to discover what faith looks like, because Abraham stood out in his generation because he said, I believe you, God. Think of it for a moment. The number of times that God has issued a command for your life, whatever it might be. Did you do it? What does your obedience look like? And yet Abraham, simply at the command of God, leaves everything behind and he goes. Faith is saying to God, I believe you. I trust you. Unbelief is saying to God, I don't believe you and I won't believe you. And as the story unfolds, it's not just that there's faith described. With the story, because of the humanity in Abram and Sarah, there's all kinds of chaos. And chaos when unbelief raises its head. Chaos when Abram begins to look out for himself rather than his wife. And there are consequences that unfold with these choices. And you can't help but think that when you look at Abram's life, you see that modern context of a dysfunctional family. And it's a dysfunction that then goes down through the generations. And it comes from the choices of unbelief that Abram makes. Joyce Baldwin, a commentator, says this: does our disobedience ever fail to damage and sadden the life of someone else? It does. And what we discover in the life of Abram is this extraordinary faith that believes God, but at those moments of unbelief, he makes choices that the consequences of which are felt not only by him, but others. A phrase that grieves me is this: is that we place burdens on the shoulders of our children that their shoulders were never designed to bear. That's Abram at times. And it's not just consequences that we see through these chapters. We see character emerging. And the question was, whose character? Is it Abram's character? Is it Sarah's character? Is it Lot's character? What we discover is that it's about God's character, God's choices, and ultimately God's care. And into the chaos and the consequences is the choice of Abraham, Sarah, we discover God caring for the outsider. Joyce Baldwin continues with her quote. She says this: "Does our disobedience ever to fail to damage and sadden the life of someone else? And does the Lord ever fail to be gracious to those we have hurt?" And you discover that as Abram and Sarah make bad choices and they cause hurt to Ishmael and to Hagar, God says, "But I care. I love you, and I restore you." And these chapters are one of journey. Abram always seems to be on the move. They're ones of journey in fragile faith. And yet, despite the imperfect faith of Abram, listen to what Hebrews 11 and verse 9 says this: "By faith, Abram obeyed when he was called to go to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise, for he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer, his builder, is God." I had a one-way conversation with God this week, where I was saying, "God, right, I'll do this, but you have to let me know A, B, and C first." That's not faith. Abraham went without knowing where he was going because God had commanded, and God's command was enough. But what's amazing is that Abraham knows the destination, and if you want to know more of what that means, then come together tonight for the evening service. Because here's the question that you have to ask is, where are you going? If this morning in Genesis 12 is about where we've come from, if this bit is about our life in the present, well, where are you going? The destination shapes the journey. You know, you live in a culture and a world and says, it's all about the journey. What a load of untruth. It's not about the journey. The destination shapes the journey. Because if you spend your whole life climbing a ladder propped up against a rotten wall and you say it's all about the journey and you get to the top, you will be bitterly disappointed. So Abram knows what the destination looks like. Although he doesn't know. But here's the thing. Is that not only is there fragile, imperfect faith, at times you catch glimpses of what unbelief looks like. It says this about Sarah in the passage. Sarah didn't believe God could do what he promised. It's from the storybook Bible. Sarah didn't believe that God could do what he promised. And even if you get fragile, imperfect faith and glimpses of unbelief, in contrast through these chapters from 12 to 21, you've got a faithful God. The one great truth about your life is that God has always been faithful to you, even when it didn't feel like it. He's always been faithful to you. He has never broken a promise. He's a God who knows your past. He's a God who knows your present. He's a God who knows your future. And he says, "Here I am." He's the God who perseveres with you. God is not a God of second chances. Because I need a lot more than two chances. He's the God who sends a second Adam, who sends a rescuer. And here's the thing, the story of Abram is about a God in control where there are no surprises. A song that I've held on to for the last few years says this: How can I say it well when my voice can barely speak? How can I sing you a song in the midst of suffering? Though the world has let me down, all of my sorrow and pain, I will trade it for a crown. Thank you for staying with me when the night was closing in. Whatever my lot, you are still God. I will sing again. My God is still in control. And he still reigns on his throne. Though mountains may tremble and sea billows roll, it is faithful, it is well with my soul, because God is still in control. Even when it doesn't feel like it, even when it's unfair, even when I can't see the way that I'm going, the one great truth over the life of the Christian is that God has always been faithful to you. He has never broken promise, never broken trust. How do I know? Because the tomb is empty. Because he's promised to Abram. It's still true in my life. And what you discover in these chapters from 12 to 21 is God's unfolding plan, God's story of salvation. And what is announced is a birth, and a birth of a child promised to the most unlikely of pair, in the most unusual of circumstances, and yet it establishes a pattern for the rest of the Bible. When a birth is announced, in unlikely circumstances, you go, uh-oh, God's on the move. It happens at the start. It happens throughout the Bible. Think of the arrival of the birth of John, given to an elderly couple who had given up hope of ever bearing a child. But here is a birth that's going to change everything. Because this is God's doing. It says this in chapter 18, verse 14. Is anything too hard for the Lord? Does that not have echoes of the early chapters of Matthew and Luke? Is anything impossible for God? It says this, is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I'll return to you about this time next year, and Sarah will have a son. But it's not just the unfolding of God's promise. What we discover is that it's a birth that changes Sarah. Sarah, when she heard that she was going to have a baby, laughed, partly in derision at the promise of God, but partly out of bitterness. And yet what we discover at the end of the story is that a bitter laugh turns to joy-filled laughter. The unfolding promises of God take us and transform us from bitterness. Let me read some verses from John 16 and verse 20. It says this. Truly, truly, I say to you, you will weep and lament, but the world will rejoice. You will be sorrowful, but your sorrow will turn into joy. When a woman is giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come. And when she has delivered the baby, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. So also you have sorrow now. But I will see you again, and your hearts will rejoice, and no one will take your joy from you. I cannot help but think that one of the loudest noises in heaven will not just be songs of praise, but will be hearts that were once bittered, now laughing in joy and celebration at the extraordinary faithfulness of God. And here we have a birth glimpse. Sally Lloyd-Jones says in the Storybook Bible, God would do as he promised. He would always look after Abraham's family, his special people. And one day God would send another baby, a baby promised to a girl who didn't have a husband. But this baby would bring laughter to the whole world. The baby would be everyone's dream come true. Here's the thing. There's a hard road ahead. And what we see here in the Bible is a red thread that begins in chapter 12. And you follow its unbreakable story all the way to the end. God has promised rescue. He's promised a rescue. How long? How long will God be faithful? Do you like waiting? How long? When will the rescuer come? And what we discover is that what we glimpse here is fulfilled later, but what we glimpse here is that look at chapter 12, okay? So you have the unfolding. What you discover in chapter 13, almost straight away, in fact, it's even the closing verses of chapter 12, is that that promise is under pressure through the unbelief of Abram and Sarah. How's God going to get us from Genesis to Matthew when his faithfulness is met with our unbelief? It's because God is faithful. Because God rescues. But I want to kind of draw these things to close by asking a question. What's in a name? Here is the start of the story of rescue. Here is the third act of the Bible. Here is a story that if you want to understand the beginning, well, you need to end, you have to understand the beginning, and we see it all the way through to Revelation. But we said at the beginning, the Bible's got two themes, doesn't it? Rescue and, it was only 10 minutes ago, Revelation, right? So where's the revelation here? We see the rescue, promise of a child. Where's the revelation? Turn with me to Genesis 21 and 33. Right at the end of this part. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba and called there in the name of the Lord. That's one of the lovely things about Abram, the number of times he's described as calling on the name of the Lord. And Christians are at their best when in praise call upon the name of the Lord. But it says this, and called there on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. Do you remember the opening three chapters? Well, we're struggling to remember Revelation and rescue, maybe not. But do you remember one of the things that we said, that God's name changes with each chapter? God, the Lord God. And one of the things that we said was that here is God revealing himself through his name. That God is revealing more about his character. He's revealing more about himself. He's revealing more about his purpose. And what you discover is that when it says at the end of this verse, he called in the name of the Lord, the everlasting God, the word and the name for God here is El Olam. And it is the first time it appears in the Bible. It only appears twice in Jeremiah. And it only appears once in Isaiah. Only four times does the name El Olam, the everlasting God, appear in the Bible. So what is God saying about himself at the start of this story of rescue? He's saying, look at me. I'm not going anywhere. I am your past. I am your present. And I am your future. And at the start of the journey, God says, I am not going anywhere. I am the everlasting God who does not change. Rescue. Promise of a child who will turn bitterness into joy-filled laughter. Revelation, look at the one who will do it. He's not going anywhere. And in Matthew, when the birth of a child is announced, what name is he given? Emmanuel, which means God with us. How does Matthew's gospel end? go and make disciples, and I will be with you always. God isn't going anywhere. And the story of your life, traced all the way back to Abraham, is the extraordinary faithfulness of God. And in those moments when you doubt, and in those moments where you're overwhelmed, God doesn't take a break now, because he's the everlasting God, always been faithful to you. How do you know it? Because Genesis 12 tells us. Let's pray together.